Mr. Cheeseman, reel 23. Does the name St. Valerie bring any memories back to you, Mr. Cheeseman?
It strikes a chord, but I know, no, yes, I'm pretty sure that that was one reaction to your ring. But you know, what you have to realise is that, well, my recollections of France, there's big gaps in it, far more than any other time in the war. And I suppose it put this down to the fact that here I was seeing war, the reality of war. I had suffered, well, just all over terror, a dive bombing, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And then after that, to see a person who actually had joined the same time as me in the army, not a great friend, just I knew him, and he was lying there, a shattered, bloody thing. I suppose had I retained clear memories of all, it would tip me over the edge. Shell shock, something like that. The fact that I suppose it's a self-preservation. The blame came down, and I'm not looking at this, and that sort of saved me to carry on. I honestly believe, of course, it was my Bovington, my strict army training, that helped me through the next patch. But before going on, could I just correct... Well, one point in the last tape, I was talking about my pay as a driver operator, wireless operator, as 4 and 3. It was 3 and 3. 1 and 3 for trade pay, and 2 bob a day for the soldier. It was when I became a tank maintenance fitter. And then went up to not 4 and 3. It went up to 4 and 9 because at the time I remember thinking that I'm getting 10 bob less than my father. For a 6 day shift down the colliery, he was getting 10 bob more than me. And he had to live on that. My wages would be pocket money, really. But that's putting it out.
But the 3rd Tank Brigade was in action at St. Valerie. That's why I asked if you recall it. Yeah. The dive bombing that you mentioned, did that cause casualties that you actually saw?
I didn't see any casualties. In fact, I don't think there was any casualties at all. But I couldn't swear to this at all. In fact, as regards our convoy, I can't say to the Italian, it's our convoy, we did, and it was our convoy that we're trying to hit. We didn't have any casualties, neither mechanical or physical. Anyway.
Where was your position, your convoy, in relation to the tanks who were in action ahead of you? What kind of distances are we talking about?
How far does it? Being in close country, it's not like in the desert. You can't say, oh, the tank's only half a mile away, something like that. The noise, the shells going off and what have you, to an inexperienced ear, seemed as if they were in the next field. But I would say we were probably never within a half a mile of the actual fighting tanks, whilst we were in France.
Were the tanks moving on their tracks throughout the whole of this campaign?
Yes, no tank transporters. We at least had 2 in peacetime, but probably they were all in France at the time, but I mean 2 for the whole British Army. Ridiculous, isn't it? No, and considering that I was trying to think this up the other day, and I get mixed up with First World War tanks. They had a life expectancy of 20 miles. I think our tanks had a tracks and what have you. I'm not talking about Vickers Mediums, I'm talking about the early Crusader type of tank. I think they would have in the regions of about 1,500 to 2,000 mile, which wasn't a great deal. You look at the map and the distance from, for instance, Cherbourg, where we landed, up to the Belgian border area, that's a tidy step. And not a shot fired as well, but then we didn't go across to the continent with brand new tanks. We'd done an awful lot of training in England, so we went over there with tanks that got at worst 50% or 75% of their life, mechanical life, over, and at best probably 40%. You know, such was the urgency at the time.
Were you involved in a great deal of maintenance and repair work then, whilst you were in France?
Not at all. Simply because the tanks were breaking down to beyond our capabilities. Quite a lot of our tanks went to the ROC workshops, Noremy in those days. I did once go with the tank down there, on the Seine somewhere, I can't tell you where now, but it's a haze really.
You mentioned refugees and the pitiful sight that they gave you. Did you actually see refugee columns attacked by enemy aircraft?
Oh yes. Now, can I sort of come in here and bring out really that the thoughts that I put down and given as a talk. For instance, when we had buried my comrade, it suddenly dawned, I suppose, on all of us that here we were, stopping to bury a chap. Well, there was no need to, as it were. We didn't know where Jerry was. Was he in the next field, behind the next bush? And suddenly this became reality. Get on board, lads, let's get cracking it. And off we went. Now the mist was north of Abbeville. And it was the Abbeville refugees, of course, that we were struggling through earlier in that day. But now coming towards Abbeville, the road was completely empty. And we could get a move on. And I'm telling a fib when I say the road was completely empty. There was about three, possibly four, individual soldiers, disoriented. No personal arms, nothing, just wandering. We covered them and pushed them in the back of them. And remember, we were an ordinary workshop lorry. We got our six fitters in there, plus a tank crew beginning to fill up. Further on, we came across a couple of French medical corps officers and put them on board. And we were still out in the country when we came across our first refugee going towards there, a man and wife. And he was pushing his bicycle with an unbelievable assortment of parcels on him, and his wife, it was heavily pregnant. Now, because of standing orders, we were told on no account of anything to do with any refugees. It was a fifth column business, you see. But I ask you, couldn't you think we could pass through? So we stopped, and the two Frenchmen, of course, were chatting and everything, and we compromised. We put the woman on board and told her husband that, look, we leave her at a convent, which we'd spotted earlier in the day, south of Abbeville. And off we went. And we were still in open, this is surprising, this, we were still in open country when a muffled shout from the back of the lorry caused my sergeant to do it, stop that, stop! And when I pulled up, is it right, everyone dismount? Well, bloody cherry, the whole German army, and then he said, right, get yourselves the smoke, lads. What the hell was he doing? Of course, as you can see, my nerves were sticking out my body a foot long and trembling in the air. And by the way, the two French medical chaps and the woman didn't dismount. And so I was there, you know, with the rest of the lads beside the road smoking. God, what's behind that line of trees? Do you think it's Jerry? Do you think he's even now training his guns on a single lorry? Bloody hell, you know. Oh, then it happened. It was a cry of a victory, Fox. But then it wasn't. The cry came from the back of our lorry. It was a newborn baby, little baby girl. One of our lads who were very keen on horticulture and agriculture and knew the name, you know, the Latin names, called her Viola Tricolor, Wild Pansy. And I don't know, but it was a sort of oasis amongst all the, you know, it certainly took my mind off what I'd just seen and done. Anyway, when we got the other side of Aberdeen, which was pretty well getting like a ghost town at the time, about, I don't know what, probably 4 or 5 miles south of Aberdeen, there was this convent. At least we assumed it was a convent, and it was quite correct, and we stopped there. And there was quite a lot of confab between the nuns and the two medical corps officers, and the dope start was that they were taking in an awful lot of roadside people and things like that, and got no doctors. So they stayed, and we said cheerio. And then we joined the whacking great stream of refugees and trying to get ahead of them.
How were you able to get through this massive number of people in ahead of you on the road?
Well, they would put it this way: there were more courtesy on the road than there is these days. It was very slow business, and the afternoon, the thought of little Viola Tricolor was bashed out of my mind. Another air raid, another dive bombing. Now, there's a blank. But all I can say is that although I immediately found myself in the ditch at the side of the road in the fetal condition, position, and we head, my hands over the back of my head and what have you, with umpteen bodies on top of me. When I eventually got back to my vehicle, I put the handbrake on, switched the engine off, sealed it and everything, and so on like that. But how on earth, I don't know. Anyway, we were lucky, and so were the refugees. But the refugees, one of the refugees had a cart and horse with our belongings on. It wasn't lucky. The horse had been killed, and the scattering of suitcases and what over the road. And when we got back into the lorry, this was in front of us. My sergeant didn't get on the lorry, but went ahead of this to guide me over the, you know, the debris, as it were, without going into the ditch at the side of the road. And I remember distinctly, there's another high donor, he was urging me on like a father. And then his voice suddenly changed. He says, "For God's sake, bloody drive over its bloody legs. The horse is dead. It'll not feel anything." And the revulsion of driving over a dead horse of anger, but more was to come. He said, "Right, another air raid. Get your wagon up the road as fast as ever you bloody well can here to get this cover of the trees." And when she was shouting at feeding the wagon, the lads were getting off and running into the ditch and running up the road and things like that. And he was doing I heard the scream of bomb, but I couldn't believe what was happening. Where my sergeant was,
killed, was he?
He was killed. And I did have him go over the edge. Because, you see, instead of going to the spot where he ought to have been and seeing if he was alive, I just jammed every foot onto the accelerator pedal over the crater and thing like that. I had to get me to that vehicle safe, because without that we were dead. That's my excuse. But I should have stopped to see if he was okay. By the way, it was a single bomb, if I remember now, because I can't remember any other action after that. Anyway, the warrant officer, tank commander, was there. He said, "You did the right thing in saving the vehicle, but even now I feel guilty. Even now, I was a coward, I suppose." Anyway, he was alive.
Well, you couldn't have saved him. He was.
No, if he'd been alive. In fact, there's one of his chap went back, and they couldn't find him. So that's it. Anyway,
what was the attitude of the refugees towards you? And you come to save them, and here you are running away or moving away in retreat.
Not too friendly.
Did they show it in certain ways?
Yes, and the French, vocabulary was coming at us quite a bit, but nevertheless, they didn't they weren't belligerently, physically belligerent. They would say this and get out of the way and let us go on. No, we were not their favourite taste at the time.
What were your feelings and of your comrades on the way that the Germans were attacking refugee columns? Or were they attacking you because they saw you in the refugee columns?
They were attacking us. We didn't think that they were, at the time, we didn't think that they were attacking the refugees at all. We were the targets. But of course, we were faced now with where the hell are we going to go? The sergeant had got a fair idea of where we were going to go. I think he must have been told, I don't know, there's another blank effort. He must have been told to make for so-and-so. But he'd gone, and his information had gone as well. And the next day, early on, the refugees had been sending out a bit after this, because we moved on, oh, that's a blank space now, but we moved on, obviously, faster than the refugees. Next morning, we stumbled upon, it was hot at the time, a column made of absolutely every different type of British Army vehicle that you can imagine. Oh, what it would be about dozen and a half vehicles. They were all like us, loaded down to the gunwales with stragglers. Stragglers actually that represented just about every single regiment in the BDF, or what was left of the BDF by then. And that apparently it was the work of an officer who seemed to have been, that was his job, of organising this. Because it was this officer that organised as much petrol as possible to us, to our entries, no petrol tanks they were getting low. It was that officer that organised a meal for us, a few biscuits and some of that chocolate, tin chocolate we had. It was also that officer that started talking about a place which I'd never ever heard before. Dunkirk. Where on earth was that? Good grief, I mean, we passed through many of these French villages and what have you. He wasn't speaking of these, he was speaking of another French which I'd never heard before. And if I remember rightly, he was talking about Dunkirk in past tense. Be that as it may, but anyway, we joined.
Oh, so you were heading south, weren't you? You weren't going.
Southwest.
You were coming away from Dunkirk in direction.
Yes.
So, in effect, Dunkirk could have been over.
Think it was actually. And thinking back now, I think that we were in France for quite a while after Dunkirk had finished, and of course there was an awful lot of many other soldiers.
The officer you're talking about, he wasn't a tank man, was he?
No. I can't remember what regiment at all, but I think he was a captain or something like that, you know.
What was the condition of the stragglers that you were picking up?
Oh, dejected. Dejected. I was no, my feelings were no different to anyone. We were, you must remember that in hindsight now, we had a Sunday school party compared with what was happening on Dunkirk Beaches. But we didn't know anything about that at the time. And so we were the worst. You know, it was us that was getting all the hammer and all the air in. We got no air in compared with poor lads on the beach. But anyway, we were dejected.
Who do soldiers blame when they're in that kind of mood of dejection and morale is low, spirit is low?
Any blame. That wasn't
possibly grumble might be a better word.
You know, it was just bloody hell, you know, what have you. At no time can I ever remember, I may be wrong with it, maybe something that's wiped out in my memory, but at no time did we ever say, bloody Sergeant Major, bloody Captain, sodding bloody Colonel, and what have you. It was none of that at all. I think because what officers and NCOs that we saw, we could see were in the same boat as we were, that they weren't our superiors, they were our comrades.
Were your tanks moving with you, or were they ahead of you?
I hadn't seen...
You'd lost those.
Lost all together. In fact, I believe my battalion saved about half a company and half a squadron of tanks, and they came out of Cherbourg, where we landed, actually. But I'm jumping ahead on that score. But as regards tanks, we now just forget that we were the tanks. We were BEF, and we were part of BEF. We were trying to get out of France. That, by the way, didn't even come into my mind until after this officer came with this convoy that I said, hello, we're getting out of France, you know. And I suppose that was the one big light at the end of the two-mile tunnel.
How did you, or where did you stop for your nights? I mean, obviously, you couldn't keep on the roads.
We pulled in where there was road trees. Trees across the road, but we wouldn't stand on the road, obviously, because, aircraft, and the road ended that patch of trees, and comes there, and he'd know where the bomb is. So anywhere where it was convenient to get off the road, but under cover of trees.
And where was your petrol coming from? Because obviously you'd be using it.
Well, these that were cycling out of other vehicles, we got full tanks and something like that, you see. And vehicles that were carrying, but you see, we had used up all our reserve, or we were carrying cans of petrol. I can't remember now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That would be 12 gallons of petrol, which for a lorry was probably 30 miles or something like that, you know. But anyway, what the officer was doing is saying, right, I've got this amount of petrol, this amount of food, and this one like that. Now then, you require that, so you don't, you know, and it was sort of sharing it out.
I was wondering whether you, you know, went to French.
Oh no.
Petrol stations or
no, whatever. No. I have no doubt that did happen, but
you managed without that.
We managed without it. Anyway,
food. We're still living off the land. I know you said the officer had food. But he must have been getting it from somewhere.
You see, from it actually, it was emergency rations, biscuits. No, we had no bully. No, he didn't have any bully. We had every man Jack before it went over the front had the emergency chocolate block in his tin. You know. I suppose there must have been a quarter of master stored with anyway, we got a tin between three of us and something like that, and a packet of biscuits between two of us.
And you were picking up food from wherever
as you went around. Yes. Anyway, after that is a blank. I cannot remember how many days and nights. I can't remember any air raid precautions, anything like that. But we did get to Brest, where astonishingly, field upon field upon field alongside the road was filled with British lorries and what have you. And of course we were told not to set fire because that's really one, but to sabotage our vehicles. Well, we got all the valve grinding paste that we got on board, a 7-pound tin of it, I think, for you there. And we carefully mixed it up with lubricating oil and drained the engine and filled it up with fat. So Jerry would get it, you know, he'd find his engines wouldn't run so very far. Fill the gearboxes up and things like that. That's what we did. But we, on our lorry, we were carrying spare guns and ammunition for the tanks and what have you, but and also a brain, because that was my load. We were told to leave all personal stuff there, except your playbook and what have you, because we were loaded down with weapons and ammunition. And I say my load was, believe it or not, was a brain gun. And I thought it was full, but it wasn't. It was half empty. A tin of Bremer magazines. Another chap had tripod and what have you. Anyway, I think it'd be about 10, I think. I mentioned it afterwards when I went back. 10 to 12 kilometres from Brest, from the docks, we marched, forth marched as well, as good as any infantry, by the way. And so you can imagine the absolute exhausted state we were, because we couldn't have done without our last night's rest and dive bombing and our emotions being torn to bits and what have you. And so I remember getting to the dockside, and it was cobbled, by the way, and just dropping down on the cobbles whilst we're waiting for our turn to get on board this. I have never seen such a dilapidated ship at all. We flimmer. I'm telling you this, Mary, it would surprise me if I could have navigated from North Shields to South Shields. God, love, anyway. And it was out in the middle of the harbour. And there was, because it was drawing too much water, the tide being out, it couldn't get alongside the quay side. And so it was an army, a British naval lighter, sort of thing. I always used to say, when people say what it was a destroyer. It wasn't, it was something smaller than that, which was taking us off from the quayside to the boat. Anyway, when we were lying on the ground, exhausted as it were, and resting, a few of the French doctors showed us a little bit of mercy. They'd obviously broken into a crate of full of punnets of strawberries. And we all had a punnet of strawberries each. And that was our last meal I was to have on mainland Europe until I returned there on the 3rd of September 1943. Not bad. But anyway.
Were there French troops with you as well?
No, I didn't see any. But no doubt there would be. I never saw any. But anyway, we got onto this lighter. Eager hands, the crew of the lighter, you know, took all this stuff off and things like that. We chugged out and then up the ladder from the lighter up onto this deck of this